This is the church's website, and if you just scroll down under here to recent sermons and click on lesson 134, then here is the link in the notes, and it will bring up the notes that we're going to be going through this morning. So I'm going to actually make that bigger because there's some images and stuff like that that I want to show folks this morning. So, lesson 134, the Complete Geneva Bible, Contents and Features, Part 2. Introduction. Last Sunday in lesson 133, we began looking at the contents and features found in the Geneva Bible. In doing so, we consider the following aspects of the Geneva Bible. First thing we did is we looked at the title page. We looked at the table of contents. Specifically there, we noted about some things about the Apocrypha and how the Apocryphal books are dealt with and handled in the Geneva Bible. And then we looked at the epistle dedicatory to Queen Elizabeth and some things about that related to what they had to say to the queen. And then we looked at the address to the reader and some of the different features and things that they said they were including in the 1560 Geneva Bible to aid the reader in their understanding of the scriptures. So if you look at the next point, the following citation. And let's just make that citations because these are, I flipped the order around to have it make a little more sense for these notes. The following citations from the pen of Dr. David Daniels serves as both a good review of lesson 133 and a preview of the current lesson, the lesson that we're in today in lesson 134. So let's look at this. The following citation, I already read that. So number one, the first edition, so that's this one right here, the 1560, the first edition. The first edition begins with an epistle to the queen and an address to, quote, our beloved in the Lord, brethren in England, Scotland, and Ireland, both dated from Geneva, 10 April 1560. The address is an expanded version of Whittingham's to his New Testament. Later editions added a two-page address to the Christian reader, a poem and a prayer, and a full-page scheme of, quote, how to take profit in reading the Holy Scripture. Now, I'll stop there and say, one of the things that I've noticed as I've read books and studied and did research to put these lessons together is all of the people that are writing these books don't necessarily agree. And I've come to the conclusion about the different items that are included, because some of them are in their books are making comments on later editions. They don't actually have a 1560 in front of them. They have a 1577 or a 1599 or a later edition that had some extra stuff in it. What I have here and the PDF that I'm working off of is a 1560. This is the first one that was printed at Geneva in 1560 and then imported into England. So let's look at the next quote. Quote, also, almost every chapter begins with a brief summary, numbered two verses, longer, in the New Testament. Each Old Testament begins with a quite extensive preface. Quote, the argument. So there's a little preface. I'll show you that here in a little bit. It was not explained why Whittingham's fine New Testament arguments were dropped. Titles run across the top of every page and summaries of every column. Books begin with an ornamental letter. There are maps. Before the New Testament is a map of the Holy Land. I'll show you guys that in a little while. In Exodus and elsewhere, what is being described is particularly baffling. Things like the fittings of the tabernacle or the clothing of the high priest, woodcut illustrations are inset. At the beginning of 1 Kings, there are effectively 5 pages of pictures of or relating to the temple. In the 1560, the first edition had 26 engravings. In other words, the commonly repeated observation that there are no illustrations in the Geneva Bible, should say Geneva Bible, singular, I believe, we'll have to check that, is not true. So, as we think about the contents and features of the Geneva Bible, there are a lot of images, there are a lot of pictures, there are maps that are included within it to aid the reader in their understanding. And again, I think it's important that we reiterate again, in 1560, the English Bible had been around for roughly 35 years, starting with William Tyndale, And then we went through, you know, Tyndall and Coverdale and Matthews and the Great Bible and now the 1560 Geneva Bible. So there still might be people in the English-speaking world of that time who need more help as far as navigating through their English Bible. So in other words, English Bibles are still a relatively new thing in 1560, as far as that goes. And remember, a lot of the Tyndall Bibles, some of the other ones, had been confiscated, burned, and so forth by church officials and politicians under the reign of Henry VIII. So the address to the reader identified some additional features that we will look at in this lesson. Some at the very bottom there, page one. These features include the following: the arguments and chapter summaries, illustrations and maps, tables and concordances. All right? So let's go to page two. Went too far. Let's go to page two. And I want to talk about a couple of these features, all right? So what I'm showing here on the board for those of you is for the benefit mostly of those who might be watching right now on the live stream. So at the head of nearly every book of the Geneva Bible is an argument. It's called an argument, or introduction to the doctrinal content found therein. So considering the following example from Romans. So I've taken the liberty of taking this picture and extracting it out of what's actually there. Okay, so I'm going to find Romans chapter 1 in this Geneva Bible, and I want to show you what I'm talking about. So I just took a screenshot of the top of the page. So if you look at Romans chapter 1, and I have something marked here for later purposes, you can see what I'm talking about here. All right? There's an argument at the top. That's Romans chapter 1. There's an argument at the top following the text. Okay? And it's quite long for the book of Romans. So let's just look at some of that. I don't think we necessarily need to read all of it, but let's just look at it a little bit. So I'm reading from the picture here. So the epistle to the epistle of the Apostle Paul to the Romans, and then here's what we're calling the argument. It says the argument at the top. So what they mean there is essentially like a summary or a review of the main arguments that this particular book is talking about. All right. So let's just read a little bit of this. We don't have to read the whole thing. I think you'll be able to get a sense of it. Okay. So it says, the great mercy of God is declared toward men in Jesus Christ, whose righteousness is made ours through faith. So already, I mean, that's a pretty good statement about the contents of the first five chapters, of the book of Romans. For when men by reason of their own corruption could not fulfill the law, yet committed most abominably, both against the law and the nature, the infinite bounty of God, mindful of his promises, made to his servant Abraham, the father of all believers, ordained that man's salvation should only stand in the perfect obedience of his son, Jesus Christ, so that not only the circumcised Jews, but also uncircumcised Gentiles should be saved by faith in him. Even as Abraham, before he was circumcised, was counted just only through faith, and yet afterward received circumcision as a seal or badge of the same righteousness by faith, and to the intent that none should think that this covenant which God made to him and his promises was not performed. Is that right? Either because the Jews received not Christ, which was, can't make that out. Okay, yeah, blessed seed, or else beloved, not that he was the true Redeemer, because he did not only, or was at least more notably, pursued. Not sure that word. The Jews, and examples of Ishmael and Esau declared. So now he's getting into stuff later on, right? But can you see there how that's a summary of the book? If you think about it, the first five chapters are about the guilt of humanity. Both Jews and Gentiles, all are guilty before God, right? The law declares that no man is righteous. And then faith in Christ and His finished work are the only things that will save a man today, Jew or Gentile, right? You can see that they have at least some understanding of those things in this argument that they make, okay? Anybody have any questions, thoughts, or observations? We're going to say more about this next Sunday when we look at the marginal notes, because there are Calvinistic marginal notes in the Geneva Bible, okay? Now, would that surprise you? That shouldn't surprise you, because it's done where? It's done in Geneva. Who was running Geneva? Switzerland. Calvin was, right? So are these guys going to be influenced by Calvinistic thinking as they are living as exiles in Geneva, Switzerland? Now, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll talk more about that next time, okay? On the same page, so go to page 3 of the notes. On the same page, readers of the Geneva Bible also encounter a chapter summary or outline for Romans 1. Chapter summaries such as this are present for every chapter in the entire canon. Okay? Whoops, that was wrong. So let me show you what I'm talking about there. So this is on the same page as what we just looked at. So here is the beginning of Romans. Here's the argument at the top of the page that we just read from. And then right here is the chapter summary that I have in the picture there. So there's a brief statement along with verse numbers about what the reader is going to find in Romans chapter 1. So let's read that. So I'm reading from this image here in the notes. It says, Paul showeth by whom and to what purpose he is called. So that's verse 1. Verse 13, his ready will. Verse 16, what the gospel is. 20, the use of creatures and wherefore they were made. 21 through 24, the ingratitude perversity and punishment of all of mankind. So in other words, if you're thinking about this from a bird's eye view, before you read the text of Romans chapter 1, is it true that Paul is going to begin the chapter, Paul showeth by whom and to what purpose he is called? So let's look at that. Grab your King James Bible and let's just look at that. We're just going to use the King James because it's obviously easier for you to read, and I didn't include the text of Romans 1 in the notes. But if you just look at this outline that the Geneva translators are giving. So let's look at verse 1. Romans chapter 1, verse 1. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated unto the gospel of God, which he hath promised before by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his Son Jesus Christ our Lord, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power, according to the Spirit of holiness by resurrection from the dead, by whom we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations. So let's go back to this. So verse 1, Paul showeth by whom and to what purpose he is what? Called. Is that what the first verses are about? Yes. Verse 13. His ready will. Let's go to verse 13. He says in verse 13, now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come unto you, but was let hitherto, that I might have fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles. I am a debtor to the Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. So again, back here, starting at verse 13, does he talk about his will and intention towards them? Okay, verse 16, what the gospel is. Well, you all know Romans 1:16, right? For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. Now we get to verse 20. The use of creatures and wherefore they were made. Verse 20. So he's got verse 20 on this. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without what? Excuse. Let's go back to this. So then you've got 21 through 24, the ingratitude, perversities, and punishments of all mankind. Start at verse 21. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like unto corruptible man, and to birds, and to four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, etc. Okay, so here's what I want you to see. These chapter headings giving the reader an outline of every book of the Bible. So there's, for every book, nearly every book, there's a book argument, a book summary of the entire contents of a given biblical book. And then there is a brief chapter outline or overview at the beginning of every chapter, like we see here in this example from Romans chapter 1. So could we look at a whole bunch more of examples of other books? Yeah, we could, but I don't think we need to do that. I think you guys can see sufficiently by looking at that what the issue is there, okay? Now, let's just finish this point under the image. The apocryphal books do not contain arguments, but they do contain very short chapter summaries. So the books marked Apocrypha in the Geneva Bible, none of them have an argument like this in front of them like we see here at the beginning of Romans. They have very short chapter summaries like this. So let me show you what I'm talking about. Just got to find an apocryphal book. So here's the Wisdom of Solomon. Starts at the bottom of this page, and you'll see there is no argument there. It just starts the Wisdom of Solomon. It's not like the rest, and then there's a very short summary of chapter 1 right here. Okay? So they're treating things differently there too. And remember, at the top of every page of the Apocrypha, they are all stamped with the words what? Apocrypha. So they are definitely seeking to denote the fact or clarify to the reader that they do not view those books as scripture. All right? Okay, before we move on, does anybody have any questions or comments about that point? The reason I'm talking to you about all of this is because these features help explain why the Geneva Bible was so popular. If you had one of these Bibles, did you have all kinds of information here to try to help you understand the text? You did. You had marginal notes, you had cross-references, you had arguments, you had chapter summaries, you had all of these things that were included to help you with understanding the book. So, let's move on to the next category then, illustrations and maps. As noted above, Professor Daniel addressed the myth that the Geneva Bible contained, quote, no pictures. There were no pictures in the Geneva Bible, writes no less a scholar than the 16th century Patrick Collison, revealing that even Homer nods and showing how pervasive is myth. Professor Collison is far from alone in that observation. The 1560 Geneva Bible has 33 illustrations, most of which went forward into most following editions. Some later editions varied this. Two of these are title page emblems, and five are maps, four of them being spread over two pages. The rest are to illuminate details of the tabernacle or temple or the visions of Ezekiel, again, one being spread over two pages. The intention is edification over titillation. Unlike other Bibles of the time and later, there are no jolly pictures of a half-clad Potiphar's wife reaching out to hold a fleeing Joseph, of David watching Bathsheba bathing, or a naked Susanna being spied upon by lascivious elders. Now, I have to be honest with you here. I remember even as a kid seeing Bibles with pictures in them and seeing, like, Joseph running away from Potiphar's wife, and Potiphar's wife's clothes are, like, half on her body. You know what I'm talking about? Like, or David, you know, seeing Bathsheba bathing and stuff, and they've got these pictures. So what Professor Daniel's point is that all of the images that are included in the 1560 Geneva Bible, they are all designed to be teaching images. They're not designed for anything else, right? So you've all seen, I'm trusting I'm not the only one that has seen a Bible that had pictures like that in it, okay? Between 1568 and the last printed in 1715, a King James with Geneva notes, it was precisely the Geneva Bible which carried the tradition forward. Tyndale's Pentateuch has pictures, and his 1534 New Testament has a heavily illustrated Revelation. Now I want to stop there. Remember, going all the way back to Luther's New Testament when we first started studying these Bibles, did Luther's New Testament have a ton of pictures in the book of Revelation illustrating the different scenes that are happening throughout the book? So there is a Reformation tradition of including images to help the reader visualize and understand what is going on. Now you can make the argument, and I wouldn't argue, and I wouldn't dispute it, that not all of these pictures are necessarily helpful. That's not the point right now. The point right now is to understand that they're definitely included in it with the goal of trying to help the reader. Okay? Whether they actually are helpful, I mean, that's probably a point that could be debated. Okay, so continental Bibles were often lavishly illustrated. What historians should have noted is that there are no illustrations in the 1611 King James Version. I have two copies at home of facsimile reprints of a 1611. There are no illustrations in a 1611. None. So all this stuff that we're talking about, they don't have any illustrations in the King James Bible, aside from the title pages and those kinds of things. But once you get into the text, there are no illustrations in the text. The Reformation interest in pictures in Bibles became pushed to the side into the making of children's Bibles. So this is my Scofield Reference Bible right here. There are no illustrations in this Bible, okay? The only thing that might remotely count are some maps and some diagrams and stuff that are in the back. So what he's saying here is that now, if you want a Bible with illustrations, you're going to have to get what kind of a Bible? A kid's Bible.
Or a vintage Bible,
or go get a reprint of a 1560 Geneva Bible. Now, I'm not saying all of this because I think all of this is absolutely required. We're saying it and noting it as matters of history, okay? So let's go to page 4. Blackford Condon, in his The History of the English Bible, includes a detailed listing of the maps, illustrations, as well as other precise locations within the 1530 Geneva Bible, as well as their precise locations within the 1560 Geneva Bible. The following screenshots are from pages 240, 249 to 250 of Condon's book. So here's what I did. Instead of typing all of this out, I just went in there and I screenshotted the text that I wanted. Saved me probably 45 minutes. Okay? So, besides annotations, they added maps. And here's this word again, I'm not sure what they mean. Cosmography. I need to look that up, I forgot to do that.
Related to the word cosmos, so it's the universe.
Okay.
The stars and...
It makes me wonder when the word geography first was used. Because we would refer to it now as what?
Geographic,
right? Geography. For the perfect understanding and memory of diverse places and countries, partly described and partly by occasion touched both in the Old and New Testament. In the edition of 1560, published by Hall at Geneva, these maps are on a small scale, covering sometimes half, at others scarcely half the page. The first map indicates the location of the Garden of Eden. So I think I have this one. So let's scroll down just briefly. You don't have to, as I'll put it on the screen. So here's the first one. So this is within the text, and it says the situation of the Garden of Eden, and there's a map here with explanatory information. So I'm going to zoom out there for a second. So here's the first map. Here it says Mesopotamia. It's got the Euphrates River. It's got the Tigris River, and it's talking about the location of the Garden of Eden. And then it has an explanation of the map down here. All right, now let me actually show you that. Because it sits, like, right in the middle of the page. So here is Genesis. It's right within the text of Genesis chapter 2. So I just went in here and cut out the picture. But here's the text of Genesis chapter 2 on this page, and the map of the location of the Garden of Eden sits right in the middle of the page. Okay? So go back to the notes, page 4. So the first map indicates the location of the Garden of Eden, Genesis 2:10. The second, the journey of the Israelites through the wilderness, is in Numbers 23. So I have that marked here. So here's the second map on the journeys of the children of Israel. So that's what it looks like. I didn't give you all of these because I filled the whole notes just with pictures. So there's the second map. The third map, the land of Canaan as divided among the several tribes. That's in Joshua 15. So here's that map. You see the map of the division of the land of Canaan amongst the Israelite tribes as they enter the land under Joshua. That's the third map. And there's a map of the Holy Land as it was at the time of Christ at the beginning of the New Testament. So here is the beginning of the New Testament, and here is the map of the Holy Land at the time of Christ. So they're giving these maps for the purpose of what? Aiding the reader, right? Helping the reader. And then here's another one, before Paul's epistles, of the Mediterranean world and the apostolic journeys of the Apostle Paul. It's at the end of the book of Acts, beginning of the book of Romans. Okay? So these are included to try to help the reader to understand things. So back to this, bottom of page 4. The maps are designed, though, rudely to show the physical elevation of the country. So if you look at these maps, there are topography lines. If you're familiar with maps, a lot of maps have lines of topography to indicate elevation changes. They are doing that in a rudimentary way on the maps that I just showed you. So top page 5. In addition to the above popular characteristics of the Genevan Bible, there is one other which deserves mention, and that is the number of its illustrations. The first edition, 1560, contains the following. The Ark of the Covenant, and that's you can find a picture of it at the Ark, the Ark. So I'm going to scroll down in page 7. There is the illustration of the Ark. So Just Noah's Ark, not the Ark of the Covenant. I said that wrong earlier. So it's just like a box in the illustration floating in the water with a couple notes about the box. So you'll see there are letters here that are identifying explanation notes here on the margin of the illustration of the ark. Everybody see that? So again, just to give you a sense of what that would have looked like, here it is actually on the page. You can see it's at the bottom of the page there. So they're aiding the reader there, trying to help them understand and visualize the ark. All right. So let's just read through the list. So you have the ark, the Egyptians pursuing the Israelites. That's actually the image from the title page. The Ark of the Testimony, the Table of Showbread, the candlesticks, the first covering of the tabernacle, the curtains of goat's hair, the tabernacle, the altar of burnt offering, the high priest in his official robes, the altar of incense, the laver of brass, the tabernacle with the tents pitched about it, the temple uncovered, the temple covered, the first figure of of the king's house, the second figure of the same house, the form of the pillar, the great cauldron, the form of the cauldron, the royal throne of Solomon, the vision of Ezekiel, the description of the temple. So all of those are illustrated. So I've included a few of them, not all of them. So here is here's the one of the altar of burnt offering. So you can see the illustration here of the offer of the altar of burnt offering. They kind of have it broke up in pieces, and then all of the different pieces are lettered with an explanation here in the margin, as you can see from the image. Okay. Another one I included is the one about the garments of the high priest. So here is the image as it appears, the garments of the high priest. So here's a drawing of the high priest in his high priestly garments, and then they are labeled and lettered with explanation down here. So the whole point of these illustrations is for the purpose of what? To aid the reader, right? To aid the reader in his understanding. So if you think about Ezekiel, so here are some of the other ones. I didn't include all of these, there's too many, but here's a description of the temple. So there's 33 of these at least all through the Geneva Bible that are there for the purpose of aiding the reader. So if you are in your notes, we've looked at the image on page 6 of the map of the Garden of Eden. We've looked at the ark image. We've looked at the altar of burnt offering on page 7. We've looked at the image of the high priest in verse on page 8. So let's go to page 9. Now, does anybody have any observations, thoughts, comments, or questions before we move on to the next point? So, again, all of this helps explain why this became the Bible of English-speaking people for over a century. Because of all the information, this thing is jam-packed with information to help them understand the text. Whether it's the maps, the illustrations with the explanations, whether it's the arguments, the chapter summaries, the verse, the chapter and verse numberings, all of it is designed with the goal of trying to help the English reader understand the Bible. Okay? So anybody have any, I really think you could say that this is the first English study Bible. I don't think that would be a misstatement to say that. I think that's probably an accurate statement. Any questions?
Well, if some people did not know how to read, I think the pictures would be really helpful in some ways.
Oh, yeah. Or if they struggle with reading, for sure. Remember what I've said before about stained glass windows.
Yes.
Why did these churches have stained glass windows in them? It was because, for most of world history, the population was illiterate. And so the stained glass windows were designed to actually be a teaching mechanism of the Bible, the stories of the New Testament. I've told you this before. For a couple years growing up, I went to a Lutheran school. And we would have chapel. And we'd go into this pretty fancy Lutheran chapel. And all down the aisles are stained glass windows of different stories from the Bible, like the feeding of the 5,000 and the catch of fish that John and his brother take in. Just all these stories are there in the stained glass. So, yeah, I agree that for a population at the time, images and stuff like this were probably very helpful to them as far as understanding things. And I'll say this too, like now, today, do we know a lot more about, I'll just say for lack of a better term, biblical archaeology than they probably knew then? Yeah, I think we do. So, anything else? Alright, so let's go to page 9 and let's talk about tables and concordances. Tables and concordances. So, regarding the tables found at the end of the 1560 Geneva Bible, Professor Daniel states the following quote. From the first 1560 edition and right through until the mid-17th century, there were tables at the back of the volume, the table of the first neatly illuminating for us how the system was. Quote, a brief table of the interpretation of the proper names, which are chiefly found in the Old Testament, where the first number signifieth the chapter, the second, the verse. So, in your notes, go to page 10 quick. So if you go look at page 10, here is what we're talking about. A brief table of the interpretation of the proper names, which are chiefly found in the Old Testament. And then all this here explains how it works. And then if you look at it, here you have an alphabetical list. So number one is Aaron. The first list in the alphabetical list is Aaron. It gives an alternative spelling, and it says that he's a teacher. So, and then it gives Exodus chapter 4, verse 14. So let's go there. Let's go look at Exodus chapter 4, verse 14. Exodus chapter 4, verse 14. Exodus 4:14. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? So there is the identification of who? Aaron, the Levite thy brother. I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee. And when he seeth thee, he will be glad in thine heart. So this is in the chapter where Moses is objecting, right? Moses is saying, oh, no, no, don't pick me. I don't speak very well. And what's God's response? Who cares? Who's that? Isn't that Aaron, your brother? So they've identified here for the reader, Aaron. They've identified Aaron as a teacher, and they've given the chapter and verse where Aaron first shows up. Okay? And they do this. This list runs, I'll show you here. This list runs for a number of pages. So the first table starts here on this page. It's the same page, you have a picture of in your notes. So that runs for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages, giving a listing of people from the Old Testament in alphabetical order, telling you briefly something about them and where to find them mentioned in the Old Testament. Part of the problem is Methuselah. Methuselah just says asking. It just says, if I'm reading it right, it says asking death. Genesis 4:18. Some of it's hard to read sometimes. So
I heard it said, his name, man, when he dies, it's still coming for the flood. So
yeah. So Genesis 4:18, let's just look at that. Yeah. And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat whoever that is, and whoever that is begat Methuselah. So there's the first time Methuselah is mentioned, and it's telling you the meaning of his what? Name. So I don't know, Schofield doesn't have that in here. What have you heard it means?
When he dies, it shall come, because he was the longest man to live, recorded in the Bible for 969 years, and it just showed God's long suffering to judge the world with a flood. He died right before.
Yeah, now that you mention that, I've heard that said too. According to this, they are defining Methuselah as asking death. So I don't know if that's a overly literal rendering of the Hebrew, but they have identified his name. They've given them something, and then they've given the chapter and verse where to find it. So that goes on for about 8 pages. This list, the alphabetical listing of the names of people in the Old Testament.
That's pretty cool.
It is kind of cool. And again, like, I can sit here with my tablet, go to Blue Letter Bible, type in Methuselah, and have it like that fast. Then I can look it up and I can do all this stuff, right? So are things like this going to really help a person, an English-speaking person at the time, get more out of their Bible? Yeah. And they're designed to aid somebody who is going to really be a reader and a student of the English Bible. Okay? So let's go back to page 9 in the notes. So those 6 pages begin Aaron, a teacher, Exodus chapter 4, verse 14. One of the reasons given in the heading to this table is that not knowing the true meaning of Old Testament names has led to the godly out of ignorance giving infants instead of names, quote, that should ever have some godly advertisements in them, the signs and badges of idolatry and heathen impiety. So in other words, one of the reasons they're giving this is so like you don't accidentally name your daughter Jezebel. Okay? Or, you know, you don't accidentally name your son Nimrod. Or something, you know, and maybe you wouldn't do that anyway, but you understand what I'm saying. So like, one of the reasons, it says that, so if you read the details of this description, it literally says in there that one of the reasons they're giving this is so that the godly don't name their children after some heathen god or goddess or some crazy thing, right? Just grabbing a name from the Old Testament. That's what it says. So, if you... Yeah. Let's finish that paragraph. Alternative versions of the names are conveniently given in the margin. So sometimes there's alternative names as Henoch, taught or dedicated, dedicate, Genesis 5:18, has in the margin Enoch. So that's interesting. Because how do we spell Enoch now? Now we spell it the way it's in the margin. Or Bathsheba, the seventh daughter, or daughter of an oath, 2 Samuel 2:3. Bathsheba. Bathsheba. So that's an alternative spelling, right? So let me see if I can find you and show you what that's. It should seem pretty straightforward, but so we'll find Enoch. That would be an easier one to find. Maybe. No, because I'm spelling it wrong. I'm thinking of it the way that we spell it. Here it is. So at the top of this page was an entry for Enoch, and then in the margin it has Enoch. Okay? As the alternative spelling. The second regular table, filling 15 pages after the order of the alphabet in three columns, is of the principal things that are contained in the Bible, as taken at random. Not a hair of them shall perish that suffer for Christ, Luke chapter 21, verse 18. Our hairs be numbered, Matthew chapter 10, verse 30. Christ the heir of all things, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. So in your notes, go to page 11. I've included a screenshot of the first page. So we have the table a table of the principal things that are contained in the Bible after the order of the alphabet. The first number, the chapter, the second, the verse. So here again, we have just all kinds of different things here. If you look at the list, if you look at the center column. And if you go down the list, look at this. Adopted in Christ is in the list. So there's an entry for adopted in Christ. Ephesians 1:5, Romans 9:4, Galatians 4:5. So if you want to know about that topic, is it giving you three verses to look at? All right. And this table like this, this goes on for 16 pages in the back of the 1560 Geneva Bible. Okay. So, I mean, you could spend a bunch of time looking through that and understanding. Adam laboreth. There's all kinds of entries here for all different things. Adultery forbidden, Genesis 26:10, Exodus chapter 10, verse 14, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4. All of it is listed in alphabetical order, again, as an aid to the reader. So go to page 9 in the notes. Later editions of the Geneva Bible usually had two right, profitable, fruitful concordances at the end of the volume after those tables. So imagine adding now, in addition to the two tables that we just talked about, two additional concordances to the back. Those are added in later editions. Those are not in the 1560 edition. All right? The first containing the interpretation of Hebrew, Chaldean, Greek, and Latin words and names. The second comprehending all other such principal words and matters. These running to nearly 200 pages. So these extra concordances in later printings of the Geneva Bible, imagine this book with 200 pages added to the end. That's a big book. With all that material added to the back. Okay? These running to nearly 200 pages took up about 1/6 of the whole volume. So then I have there consider the examples on the following pages. We've already done that. We've looked at page 10. I showed you that. We looked at some of the names. On page 11, we looked at the table of the different, alphabetical table of different topics. And then, there's no conclusion on this? Bottom of page 11. I don't even know why I bothered including it, but in the next lesson we will discuss the theological nature of the Geneva Bible's marginal notes. Okay? So that's what we're going to look at next time. So what I want, what I'm after here is a good, thorough understanding of the history of our English Bible. Okay? So So does anybody have any questions or comments? We are done with the notes a few minutes early. Is there anything that this lesson raised that you wanted to ask about, or possibly some other topic related to the subject matter that we're discussing?
I'm just curious, on page 3, where continental Bibles are often laminated or illustrated, what exactly did it mean by continental?
That means Bibles printed on the continent of Europe in France, Germany, other country, in other languages. Okay. They tended to have many, many more pictures, illustrations, and material like that included. That's what that means.
Kind of a deluxe edition.
You remember back in October I brought in that massive thing? That really, really big Bible from 1876? That was my wife's family Bible. You remember that? Remember all the stuff that was in that thing? It was filled with all kinds of stuff. Remember, it had the gold embossed pictures of people and images from the Old Testament and all of that, right? Editions like that, maybe not quite that ornate and extensive, but editions carrying that level of illustration and so forth were more common on the continent of Europe than what we see in a lot of these English Bibles. I'm not totally sure of the exact reason for that, but it seems to be the case that that's what happened. Any other questions? So we have two topics left that I want to talk about regarding the Geneva Bible. The first one is the theological content of the marginal notes. And the second is like the later history of the Geneva Bible, later on. We've been talking mostly about the 1560, the first one. And then I want to get into the Bishop's Bible. So my goal is, as I envision things, we'll stop whenever we have covered everything leading up to the King James. So when we get through the Geneva, when we get through the Bishop's, when we get through the Reims New Testament, and we're ready to talk about the King James, we will stop the class for the summer so that I can make sure I get everything read and organized that I need to, and then we'll take all the stuff that we've looked at and we'll apply it and look at the circumstances, the translation, the method, all the stuff as it relates to the King James Bible. So, any questions? That's kind of the grand plan. So, all right, doesn't seem like there are any questions, so we'll be done a few minutes early, and I want to thank everybody who joined.